Hey there. Welcome back to Affirmative Action. I'm your host, Antoinette Grajeda. So as promised, we're going to address the elephant in the room, the coronavirus. Even though we are several months into the pandemic, it's still considered a new virus, and research about its spread, symptoms, and long-term effects are ongoing. One thing we know for certain is anyone can contract the virus, no matter your age or station in life. Another thing that's clear is the coronavirus is having a disproportionate impact on minority communities. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, compared to their white counterparts, African Americans are 2.6 times more likely to contract the virus, 4.7 times more likely to be hospitalized, and 2 times more likely to die. Among Hispanics and Latinos, they're 2.8 times more likely to contract COVID-19, 4.6 times more likely to be hospitalized, and slightly more than 1 time more likely to die. In Arkansas, the enormous impact of COVID-19 has varied among minority populations. Springdale, for example, is home to one of the largest populations of Marshallese outside of the Marshall Islands. In June, the pandemic hit the community hard. At that time, the Arkansas Democrat Gazette reported that even though they make up no more than 3% of Northwest Arkansas's population, about half of the deaths in Benton and Washington counties were Marshall Islanders. The U.S. Census Bureau estimates African Americans make up around 15% of Arkansas's population, but according to the Arkansas Department of Health, they account for about 20% of the state's deaths. To learn more about how these communities are continuing to be affected and what can be done to help them cope with the impacts of the pandemic, I spoke with Melissa Leilon, Executive Director of Arkansas Coalition of Marshallese, Medea Reith, Executive Director of Immigrant Advocacy Group Arkansas United, and Candace Williams, Executive Director of the Rural Community Alliance. Medea got us started by discussing some of the factors that have contributed to the big impact the coronavirus has had on immigrant communities.
We definitely found here in Arkansas the huge spike that we experienced as immigrants. So us as a Latinx community, our Marshallese, our Vietnamese, and other immigrant groups was largely tied to our connection with the essential workforce. Our communities did not stop working, and we were very much the pipeline that made sure Arkansas got fed and made sure businesses stayed open. And where we've seen definitely some improvement in the circumstances of our workers, it was definitely a slow response and one that we still think could continue to improve in terms of really making sure that we are giving the respect to the workers that they deserve and putting their health first as part of this process. And I think the other thing I would want to bring in this space is some of the systemic issues that really were highlighted to another level because of coronavirus. Arkansas is an English-only state, so we saw very slow translation and interpretation that rolled out, getting information to our communities. That put us behind the curve. As new systems were developed, almost everything getting translated into Spanish or Marshallese happened 2-3 weeks behind the rest of the community here in Arkansas. In addition, we had issues of the system itself. We in Arkansas don't have a lot of immigrants in civil service, so they're not inside the Department of Health. They're not necessarily inside the different state or city agencies that were really at the forefront of decision-making. And when decision-making entities were created, space wasn't immediately given to our communities to be able to inform that process. And those are things that we're still very much working on and having to resolve and had to look to a lot of just appeal to a deep collaboration with the state to try and address this issue. Although I will say where those partnerships are there, the funding, especially from the part of the state, has come very slowly in supporting those efforts.
Melissa, what about you? Can you tell me more about the Marshallese community, because they've been incredibly impacted by this?
Yes. First of all, I want to thank you for this opportunity to share our story with the general community. So I think what people really fail to realize is the landscape prior to COVID-19. What really what was the story even before COVID-19? So Marshallese, I have been through so much in terms of, you know, getting access to healthcare programs in order to keep them healthy. I mean, particularly the Medicaid program. So Marshallese can actually pay into the program, but they will never have access to it because they are, you know, because of their non-immigrant status. Marshallese are lawfully residing in the United States, but are not considered U.S. citizens. So they kind of fall into this crack, you know, what is, you do have a status, but you really don't have a status, right? So this community has suffered a lot from, you know, chronic diseases, just like diabetes, you know, heart attack, and so many other things, high blood pressure. So it's not something new to us. And a lot, you know, we're now beginning to question why this community is so vulnerable to this virus, and also even prior to the virus, to health in general. But you have to look back. I think it's very important for us to trace back to the history of how Marshall Islanders became friends with Americans. And it really started back in right after World War II, when the United States came over to the island basically occupied the island and used the island as a proving ground for their nuclear weapon. So many are questioning if the health condition really relates to that. Is there something going on in their body that ties connected to that? You know, you can't help but to think like that. But also this coronavirus gave us really an understanding of where we stand in terms of quality of life. You know, if you were to, you know, the best way for me to explain is if you were to look at a ladder, the socioeconomics ladder, this community is at the bottom. And that's the community that's been hit. That tells you a lot about their quality of life. You know, you have things like landlord and tenants issues, food insecurities and things like that. But ultimately, I think it comes down to policy. It comes down to how policy really interact to this community and how much, what's the level that policies offer to this particular community in terms of accessing programs. You know, Marshallese do not have access to Medicaid, and Marshallese don't have access to the SNAP program. So it's a pretty large issue. It's a very multifaceted to me. It's a lot of multi-layer issues that you're dealing with. You have to deal with, you know, employment issues. When Marshallese go and apply for unemployment, there is even the system is not set up, it's not conducive to recognize Marshallese as people that are in the labor force. So what happened is a Marshallese person, it takes twice as longer for that Marshallese person to get their unemployment benefit, if they do. You know, for the most part, they get denied the first time around. So it's a lot of range of stuff that we're dealing with.
Nationally, again, the statistics keep changing, but Black and Hispanic people are 3 times more likely to contract the virus than a white American. And here in Arkansas, those numbers are also high as well. I know among our African American communities, 20% of the deaths in the state are there. And for a while, you know, some of those numbers were higher, specifically Northwest Arkansas among the Marshallese. You know, at one point, the deaths in, I think, just Washington County, about half of them were in the Marshallese community. And so those numbers keep fluctuating. Candace, with the African community being, you know, disproportionately affected. What are some of the issues that you're seeing? There are a lot of these issues that we've talked about similar for you in your part of the state.
Yeah, definitely. So I reside in Phillips County. I'm, you know, born and raised there. Moved back in 2017. So the first death in Phillips County, I knew the elderly lady. So it was immediately personal and real for me. And in addition to that, around March 15th, I became very ill. I think that was the very like beginnings of the shutdowns and things like that. And I'm not a person that gets sick. I'm just not. So on the 15th, that was a Sunday, I had a little scratch in my throat. And I was like, okay, took some NyQuil at night. And I was like, it'll be gone because that's, you know, I don't get sick. That's usually what helps. So I woke up that on that Monday and it just, I felt so just horrible. I had all the symptoms around that time that, you know, tests were scarce. They were saying like, if you, you know, just weren't dying, like you weren't going to get a test. So I was like, okay, Candace, this will wear off. So I got to that through that week. On that Saturday, I felt better. I was like, okay, it's gone. On that Monday, I felt 100 times worse that following Monday. So I went through that full week. And on that Saturday, in the middle of that second week, I felt better. And then towards the end of the week, it got worse. And that's when they started saying, oh, if your symptoms come back, then be scared. So at that time, I was panicking. So I finally called the UAMS hotline and I had a presumed case. And she said, you know, go to your doctor on Monday. I couldn't get in until the 31st, which was that Tuesday, which was 18 days after I first started exhibiting, I think 18 days after I first started exhibiting symptoms. So I took a test on that Tuesday. I got the results back on that Thursday. I was negative. So I don't, to this point, I don't know what it was. Maybe, you know, I had been too out of the window to, you know, for it to still test positive. I don't know. But like knowing the first person that died in my county, that, you know, it immediately was personal for me. And I feel like that was, it was missing for a lot of people. So they with the misinformation, the mixed information that came from the federal, the state level, it was really hard for people to know what to believe. And that became, you know, kind of the thing, like, this is not real. It's, you know, it's not happening. This is not happening. So I know for my county, before I think COVID, like the AR COVID Twitter page and everything came up, it was an attorney in Phillips County. He was the one that started reporting the numbers every day. And that's when you can see, like, people started sharing it, and it became real when this trusted voice and a Black attorney, when he started sharing these things and saying, y'all need to wear your mask, you know. So it didn't come from a county official. It didn't come from our county judge or mayor there. It came from a city attorney, but he was trusted by the community. And I feel like that's when it really started to resonate with people. I started seeing more masks and everything at that point. So I feel like that's what has been just the chaos of all of this, the misinformation, the mixed information that has come from the top. And it's, to this day, it still affects, you know, how people perceive this very dangerous and, you know, harmful disease, I mean, of, you know, COVID-19.
So speaking of mistrust, I think there's multiple levels of that as well. You have mistrust in that you have information that's mixed, and so you don't feel like you can believe it. And then you have this level of, like you said, this information came from a Black attorney, so it's someone who looks like me, so I can trust that person, right? Mm-hmm. Well, another piece of that too is, as we're recording this, you know, the Attorney General just filed a lawsuit against Arkansas Regenerative Medical Center in Fayetteville for allegedly fraudulently promoting these treatments to cure COVID-19 to the Latino community. So how do you combat issues of mistrust when you have bad actors like this who are, you know, you can say that the health officials, you know, it was a mistake. It's a new disease. They're trying to figure out the best thing. But then you have, you have these issues of scams going around to these communities that already don't trust the people in charge. So what do you do with that? Mireya, were you surprised by this instance in particular with this center working with a Hispanic radio station in Northwest Arkansas and like trying to get this information out? Were you surprised or had you been hearing about these type of scams?
No, thank you, Antoinette, for bringing that into this space. We only became aware of the lawsuit yesterday and have since been doing our best to get caught up on all the details. But to answer your question simply, and I regret we're not surprised that this happened. We knew that the risk was there. And that's why organizations like the three of ours that are on this podcast, right, have really doubled down in the community navigation work since the get-go to try and do outreach and education in our communities. And so we're beyond devastated that despite our efforts, the realities and it's maybe a combination of desperation, especially knowing personally the DJ that's involved. We know that there was just so many people that wanted to help, that wanted to give hope in the community. And there's a part of us that just has to believe there was some intentions here of just wanting to do something positive when literally there was so much fear and so much anxiety in our community. But our message to our community right now is, yes, we continue to all have to work together to educate each other and to make sure not just on the medical options and the facts, but also on our rights to be able to lift up our voices when we have instincts that something's not right. And what we've been trying to really impress with the community, I know as much as this is a tragedy, this is also evidence that the system can work, right? This lawsuit came to be because brave members of our community lifted up their voice and said, this is wrong, right? We know this is wrong. We know this is not factually correct. And it's not right what's happening. And they engaged our state institutions to investigate and then to protect the rights of our community. And so we definitely, being educated, being informed, tremendously important. But now more than ever, we really want our community not to give up hope in the institutions. That's where we've doubled down in this commitment to work with the state, to work with the local government, to work with the federal government. And obviously this electoral environment and the polarization is not helping. And also what doesn't help us as immigrants is obviously all the changes as related to immigration and just enforcement after enforcement increase that really, you know, even enhances the distrust. But we need to be able to make the systems work for us, to engage others, and then to really work hard to make sure our communities know they're not alone. If they disengage, if they don't participate in getting tested, that affects all of us, right? And that's our message with these scams. Every Arkansan should be worried about this, not just the Latinx, every, because the minute we have any community not engaging actively in the testing process and best practices, that affects everybody's health.
Melissa and Candace, have you heard of other scams like this around the state?
No, I haven't heard of a scam to that degree.
Yeah, I have personally received phone calls from that sort of folks there who are trying to scam the community. But, you know, we need to keep in mind that immigrant communities are very vulnerable to target. And, you know, of course, folks who have the interest in money, they're always going to go after these communities. But I think, as Maria had mentioned, you know, there is a system in place. And, you know, we are, in my particular community, where, you know, there has been a lot of scamming going on. I mean, there's where there's adoption or other things, things that are smaller, to a smaller level, there's still scams. So I think what these folks, predators, fail to realize is that this is a community of resilience and people talk. You know, whether you know, you're doing the right thing or not, they will know. I mean, this community will step up and they'll talk about things like this. So I'm very glad to be a part of this community that everyone is looking out for each other.
How much does culture and perhaps health officials' lack of awareness of other cultures impacted how the disease has spread throughout these communities. For example, when it was spreading so quickly in Northwest Arkansas, say among the Marshallese community, one of the things that someone pointed out is that, or even the Hispanic community, I think it was Dr. Jose Romero, the health secretary, who was saying that, you know, it's not uncommon for immigrants to live in multi-generational households. And so instead of somebody living, you know, in a home by themselves where they could quarantine, there may be a whole family of seven people from grandma to baby, and there's not a way to quarantine. And so that was one way that things could spread so quickly. So along those lines, are there cultural aspects that maybe people aren't familiar and need to think about addressing? You know, a mistrust of doctors, is that a thing? You know, something along those lines?
I think it's the mistrust. And for, I know for the Black community, and that stems back to, we can go back to Tuskegee, you know, so that still resonates, you know, with people my age. And then you have this factor of, you know, health insurance. You know, some people don't have it, they can't afford it. And some people just don't believe in going to the doctor. And I know that's something in my community, where you don't go to the doctor until, you know, you have to. It's this thing of, you know, we're resilient, we're going to keep going, we're going to keep fighting, whatever this is. Like, I tried to fight through that illness I had. Like, okay, I'm going to keep going. Because I always joke with my mom, say, I can't afford to get sick. And I can't. You know, that's real for a lot of people. We can't afford to get sick. So I have myself to take care of, my son. I can't afford it. So, you know, we're just used to just taking a licking and keep on ticking. You know, going to the doctor is not a thing until, you know, we just have to. So, you know, there's the mistrust, there's the lack of adequate, accessible, affordable insurance, and you know, just not being attentive to oneself as far as like recognizing, okay, this is something I need to go to the doctor for now.
I can speak to the the trust issue, and as Candace, it's the same way, but maybe worse, because Marshallese just seem to feel like they're not being treated the way they should be as patients in these clinics or the hospitals, because they feel like, because I don't have health coverage, so I'm not gonna get the same treatment that I get, that, you know, I should be getting. And we've had stories, we had stories even from our own board members who were, you know, affected by COVID-19. And these are American citizens. We do have, and they're Marshallese Americans. They were admitted into the hospitals, and the treatment that they were receiving from that end, you know, I couldn't believe it. So you wonder why a lot of our people just rather die at home, rather stay at home. Actually, I was on a call. I was literally on the phone with one community member who passed away, ended up passing away. And he was on the phone and he was sick, and I recommended that he admit himself into the ER, and he said no. And I said, "Why? How come? I've been into the hospital and I don't feel like I'm being, I'll be treated right there." So I had to call our own Marshallese nurse, who works for the health department, to really talk him into calling the ambulance. But the nurse ended up calling the ambulance, and she went there, and it was, you know, but 3 days later he died. But yeah, I'm always curious about what he's thinking of, you know, the moment that he passed. You know. But there's a lot of things that I think are happening, you know, that really magnify spread the virus quickly. In the community, especially the, like you said, the multi-generational community. But you also need to look at, are we doing something? As a state, are we doing something? We knew this was coming, but were we prepared to address this? Even, you know, especially those underserved communities with unique culture, were, did we even think about them? And the mixed messaging that we're sending. Yes, we were getting to a point where we were losing Marshallese every day. And we were still being encouraged. I mean, the economy was open. So what kind of message are we sending out to the community? So a lot of things.
Going forward, one thing that people do seem to agree on is the only like sure solution to this is a vaccine, which they're working on. But then there's questions about how that will impact the minority communities. There are some state representatives I've heard nationally speaking about, you know, who's going to get it first? Will there be enough for everybody, and who's going to get that first? If it's going to go to, say, the wealthiest people first, well, then that's going to impact minority communities because they're less likely to get it. Also, do they have access to the clinical trials? You know, are they being represented in these clinical trials? What needs to be done to ensure that these communities are part of this process of finding a solution and that they have, you know, an adequate chance to have access to this vaccine when they're being disproportionately affected by this disease?
I think it's going to take a lot of hard work from the government or the powers that be to convince a large portion of the Black community that this is a vaccine that we all need to take. You know, I've just, you know, I've been saying things, you know, from, you know, my friends on Facebook to memes, and, you know, they don't trust it. They do not trust it at all. They say, well, we're going to wait till the first batch goes out, and, you know, things like that. So it's going to take a lot of, I know we're all ready for this to be over with, and, you know, seemingly the vaccine is the way to the route, you know, to take, but it's going to take a lot of work from the government, and maybe they'll need assistance from community organizers or entities that are more trusted within the community to really lay home the message of, hey, we all need to take this. But it's going to take a lot of work for people to trust this thing.
We would agree with Candace, and part of the reason since the beginning our appeal to the state has been working with social influencers and trusted members of the community to be able to try and communicate these messages. Now more than ever, it's just crucial that the community is hearing from definitely their politicians, but also from their neighbors and their family and their friends, and to really build a movement around that. It's just hard right now because they're not seeing a whole lot of results, and they've been left out of the system. And there's just so many more examples out there of the community being neglected than supported. And so the other recommendation we've been giving is we need to work together to lift up some of these success stories. In working closely with Spanish media, we now have a coordinated effort with Spanish media across the state in trying to improve communication to our community. One of the things that we both have found, both on the media side and us on the organizing side, is that what is really getting the most traction in our communities is those individual stories. And to give you all an example, there was a woman that made quite a few ripples in our community, making statements about not getting tested and this is all a hoax. And then a few days later, her father ended up in the hospital and died. And then she came to Univision and to our community and said, please, I want a chance to go on the record and correct what I said, right? It's not a hoax. This is real. And I was personally impacted. I need others who think the way I did to know the truth. And I think it's going to be more of those individual testimonials from our neighbors. That really is what it's going to take in this moment to get the wide participation, both still on the testing, right, and participating in the regulation, but also on this of the solution and the vaccine.
In terms of how do we ensure that this vaccine is, you know, distributed equally into all communities, I think, you know, what I hate to see is, you know, all the decisions that are made at the state level and stop there. You know, I think we need to include the community in those decision-making process all the way down. I mean, you have churches, you know, we have over 40 churches in our community. They are pillars. And, you know, over 80% of our adults are what we call followers or believers. So, you know, just simply by that, you can tell that the church is, it's a huge pillar. So we need to, you know, it bothers me that this isn't always made, have the you know, certain level, and only certain people have access to those information or resources. This need to come trickle all the way down to the lowest level. And again, as Maria has mentioned, you know, use influencers, use the resources that you have to uplift and to let the message out that this is safe and it's okay. What I want to see is really personally is a success story. As anyone received this vaccine, is it really, because right now people are, it's a big question mark. I don't know. I mean, I don't trust it. I need to know. I need to see it with my own eyes. I need to hear a story that is working.
So along those lines with the vaccine, as these clinical trials are going on, to get a better representation of the population as a whole, you need people from minority communities to sign up to be a part of it. But how do you get them to do that if there are, like, A, are they being asked even? Because historically, clinical trials don't necessarily fairly represent the nation as a whole. So are you being asked? But also, if you are, how do you convince them to try a new drug that, like you said, isn't proven, when I already don't trust the health officials about, you know, regular doctor stuff to begin with? Like, it's such a, like, difficult situation. Is there an easy answer? I mean, is there a solution to this? Because you want people from your community to participate in these clinical trials, but at the same time, how do you, you know, trust someone to do that?
I know they are trying to, I guess, make it real or resonate with some African Americans. I saw the president of Dillard University, who used to be Philander's, he's called the hip hop president. I can't think of his name now, but he, you know, is going through a trial of the vaccine. So maybe, like Melissa was saying, seeing more people like that and have them be very transparent about their stories would help, you know, get more people on board to do the trials. But having figures like that, or, you know, if they were able to get an everyday person, that would be even better. Someone that we knew from our communities. It just takes that one trusted person. But again, that, like Melissa and Maria were saying, it's, you know, it's a lot of work to be done to undo and untangle like how business has been done as usual, like keeping everything top heavy and excluding us from the very much so tables and conversations that we need to be a part of all along.
I think for these clinical trials to partner up with a very well-trusted organization, even that, I don't even think I have any trust to it, to be honest with you. And I will not recommend until I know personally that it's working. And if I was forced to recommend someone, it will be probably myself, because I feel like I'm pretty good at navigating resources and I know what I'm talking about. So, you know, I would rather put the people who understand and who do not have maybe language barrier, you know, because I would not volunteer someone who has language barriers and other things. Yeah, no.
I think we all agree that it would be beneficial if minority communities had more of a seat at the table, you know, on the state level, you know, in our instance here, or even national level, but since we're talking about Arkansas on the state level, with some of these decisions and how information is being distributed. I think we all agree that that's going to take a while. It's worth it, but it's going to take a while. So in terms of a solution now, or in terms of helping people now, something that's more tangible, like on the community level, what can an average citizen do? Like, what, if you're talking to the whole state of Arkansas right now, like, what do your communities need? What can someone do? Do you need money? Do you need food? Do you need PPE? Like,
what would actually be helpful?
So I can offer what we've been lifting up to donors across the state for the reason that you very much hit on, Toinette, right? It's going to take a while for us to build the communication systems and to make the systemic change. So both to better support our communities getting out of this crisis, but also to fend us off from the future. And so right now, a lot of the funding that's been distributed for community navigator programs is only through the end of this calendar year. And so we're definitely making a strong appeal to continue. We need more time. And we also need time to coordinate with the institutions themselves. One of the things we're excited about is trying to certify our community navigators so that they could go to work for the health sector or work for state or city government in the future. But that's going to take a concerted effort and some time for us to build. So the worst thing possible would be to undo the systems that we've created at this time. And so we need to continue investment support. The other thing we would say is because the federal government is very likely not going to pass any sort of relief, and many of our families were left out of the last relief, that we do actually need to get money into our communities to help pay bills and just to ensure their survival. A lot of those resources have dried up, and unfortunately our state government right now is in electoral politics, and I regret they're not in electoral politics for 2020, they're in electoral politics for 2022, which is really scary for us because of the implications, not just for this, but also the state legislature, and whether we're going to be able to see the type of leadership and consensus to get bills passed, to get money out the door and resources to our communities. And so in the interim, we're making an appeal to philanthropy and to private individuals that care. We'll be announcing this, a workers' fund, but a cash relief program that we were able to get an initial investment to start for anyone working in the poultry industry and anyone in farming. But we also have so many other essential workers that also need assistance. And so that's the number one thing that we're hearing, at least in the Latinx community right now. A lot of those resources, supports are done. Landlords, despite the eviction moratorium, are losing patients, and our community just needs some help to survive. And we can't let politics get in the way of that.
So we're seeing an increase need for rent payment assistance. We have actually processed ever since the very first day that COVID-19 hit this community. I think we have given out assistance to over 400 families. So we were lucky to be able to raise money to address this particular need. But again, like maybe I was mentioning, that those funding, they're dried out. We're getting ready to receive a grant that's gonna run for 2 years to address housing needs. So we can prevent families from becoming homeless. So that's, those sort of things really help. One thing that I realized that when the state processes a grant, or even if it's, in my case, I'm still waiting on a CARES Act proposal that we put in is approved, but it's taken forever for that process to go in for me to receive the funding so I can start doing what I need to be doing. So, sometimes the process takes longer, and perhaps the state needs to look at how can they, what can they do to reduce that, the process so it doesn't eliminate all barriers, just so the community can have direct access to these resources. In my case, is food, diapers, and also rent, rent and bill, household needs. How do I pay my bill? So I get a lot of those requests as well.
I would have to agree. People need the basics. When it first hit, we were able to give care packages to some of our members in each region. So, and it included, funds to help, supplies and funds to help with bills and things like that. And so it's very much so still a need. We want to be able to do it. We will be able to do it now if we have support to do it another round in the next month or so to help people at the end of the year. But yeah, before we get to the talks of vaccine, people need help with basics.
Our guests today were Candace Williams, Executive Director of the Rural Community Alliance, Melissa Leilon, Executive Director of Arkansas Coalition of Marshallese, and Medea Reith, Executive Director of Arkansas United. Thank you again for all taking the time to speak with us. For more information about the work these organizations are doing to support their communities and how you may be able to assist them, you can visit our website, argotsoul.com/affirmativeaction. And while you're there, you can catch up on our last two episodes, which address political representation and Black Lives Matter protests. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks again for spending time with us. Check back next month for a brand new episode of Affirmative Action. Until then, take care.